because that's not something I'm going to say from the front, though I just repeated it. It is so good to be with you again this morning. I am Melissa Millis, white-bodied, she/her pronouns. I am wearing a hand-woven cotton matching set, I guess is the best way to say it, with some stripes in it. And I have a little bit of a tan from living outside while on vacation at a spot that is a bit of heaven on earth, because it's my preferred mode of living. It's outside, so yeah. Upon return, I was pleasantly surprised. Voila, we are at the end of the book of Revelation. How wonderful is that, right? Those of you who might have read all the texts in between, those that we've covered here at the gathering, might also be thinking, yes, we are, and praise be to God for that. Thank you, lectionary texts. Because we are jumping from last week, chapter 7, to this week's chapter 21, all right? I'm not going to recap everything, but a ton has transpired along the journey between these chapters. We've got trials, we've got judgment, we've got the strangest and most terrible beastly encounters. Notably, though, we have skipped over a vision of Babylon falling and heaven rejoicing as the Lamb, as Christ is declared King of Kings and Lord of Lords. I want to remind us that John the Seer uses Babylon as a metaphor for the Roman Empire. So this compilation, if you will, of visionary letters is just as much a kingdom vision as it is a political statement. So moving along to our text, lectionary text for today, chapter 21, verses 1 through 6, we arrive at the vision of a new heaven and new earth. I'm going to be reading from the NRSV. You are invited to turn to chapter 21 if you'd like, or click there in your e-bulletin and find the text and follow along, or you might just simply listen. I'm actually going to eventually read through verse 8. A little beyond our lectionary text. Revelation 21, verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "See, the home of God is among mortals. He will dwell with them. They will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away." And the one who is seated on the throne said, "See, I am making all things new." Also, he said, "Write this, for these words are trustworthy and true." Then he said to me, "It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water as a gift from the spring of the water of life." This is the word of the Lord. What follows here in the next couple of verses is a brief warning of the dangers of spiritual and moral abandonment, or of serving or worshiping anything other than God. And it says, "Those who conquer," maybe better translated from the Greek as overcome, "will inherit these things, and I will be their God, and they will be my children. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the polluted, the murderers, the fornicators, the sorcerers, the idolaters, and the liars, their place will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, for which is the second," meaning second, "death." Whew. There you have it. All right, so the rest of the book is basically a tour, if you will, of this new Jerusalem, or the holy city realized. Our text today, actually, though, verses 1 through 6, seem pretty straightforward, but there are a few things I would like to note. First of all, we would do well to remember that John the Seer is writing to the seven churches in the most urbanized and crucial region of the empire. Religious persecution was intense, and the letters were meant to sustain in the midst of suffering and to hearten the weary faithful. I said this a few weeks ago, but the message's intent continues to extend beyond and to the whole church today as it did when it was written. Calling the readers to the ways of Christ and to allegiance to a different kind of kingdom, a kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. This new earth and new heaven replace what were first things, as the vision calls it. The word new, kahinos in the Greek, is repeated here several times and means a new kind, as in unprecedented, unheard of, a remaking of the world. And this will not be an ending, but rather a new beginning. A recreation. The imagery of the creation story is evident in our text. Heaven here refers, of course, to the sky or the expanse above the earth or the land. And the seas, of course, separate that land. Seas may have held additional meaning for the readers in those days due to the association of the seas with the source of all things that pursue and create destruction and death. The holy city, or the polis, if you will, the place in which God lives and the people of God live together, has been prepared. While the metaphor of the bride and the husband are sexist and problematic, I think the key to verse 2 is that there has been preparation for togetherness, a contrast to the imagery of separation previously described. This is a contrast that continues throughout the text. A vision of being among and with, dwelling together, or what I might call an intertwined oneness that stands counter to separation and is central to the kingdom vision. This is confirmed by the voice of God in verse 3, which is actually one complex sentence in the Greek. By the way, for those of you who are sitting with translations that tack on at the end of this verse and be their God, that's not in the original manuscripts, okay? This whole sentence might better be translated from the Greek as, look, the tent of God is among human beings, indeed dwelling with them, existing as kin in God's presence. I think verse 4 further illustrates this. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more, for the first things have passed away. The word here for wipe in the Greek is exalifo, which can also mean to anoint in every part. The word every in the Greek in our text, pas, means individually, but it means more than that. It means each and every, any or all, as in the whole. So collectively, or some of all the types. I was reminded that Brittany has previously pointed out the beauty of tears sticking to our faces, communicating to the world around us. They are meant to be seen. So what struck me as I read this text was that tears flow for a variety of reasons. If you're like me, when you can't stop laughing, you just start crying at the same time, and then you're really in trouble because it just doesn't stop. Or when we're moved by a beautiful experience. So what if this verse is not simply about no longer being sad, but about God entering the experience with us, wiping all of them, every kind, through feeling them, taking them on, an intertwined oneness. And then death will be no more. Death being whatever has separated, specifically the separation of our bodies from our souls, a hell of its own. None of the mourning, crying, or pain will exist when the first things pass away. But more striking, separation of anything will be no more. Verse 6 is, I think, my favorite in this text. John the seer hears the voice telling him to write it down, make special note of this, and then declares, "It is done." I imagine God saying, "Voila!" or "Ta-da!" In a world where empire believes and acts as if it has the final word, God says, "I am the first and the last letter, the Alpha and the Omega of any word." And to those who eagerly long for refreshment, I will freely give absolute fullness from the source of life. This was good news then. And it is good news today. But this vision isn't realized unless we overcome the oppressive forces through allegiance and participation in the co-creation of the kingdom. Standing against the empire, proclaiming and working toward a vision of all things new. Our friends at Enfleshed, and if you don't know what Enfleshed is, it is a liturgy site, and they do a lot of writings and providing of resources that are used in many, many settings. Our friends at Enfleshed remind us that if we desire transformation of all things, we have to commit to what is already in front of us and start dreaming, start imagining. Dreams and imagination, Adrienne Marie Brown says, are the way we make oppression temporary. The way we make oppression temporary. Through Revelation, John the seer is deeply aware of the damage that is done as the dreams of God and the forces of oppression are both enfleshed in opposition to one another. And despite this, in essence, he is asking hearers to stay steadfast, to even do the one thing that can actually get them into trouble. Do you remember what that is? I mentioned it a few weeks ago. To not affirm the divinity of the Roman emperor, which was punishable by imprisonment or execution. He calls the readers to more than passively navigate the world and to participate in the kingdom vision through disrupting and interrupting the everyday norms of the empire, trusting that through us, God is making all things new. If we honestly assess the landscape and context of today, not much has changed. And our calling as followers of Jesus remains the same. Just last week, Newark Mayor Roz Baraka was arrested as part of an ongoing protest outside a recently opened 1,000-bed ICE detention center in his city. Delaney Hall, once a halfway house next to the county prison, recently came under contract with ICE to be operated by a private contractor with a 15-year contract valued at $1 billion. This single, unusually large and long contract, even for ICE, is estimated to generate $60 million in profit every year. This private company claims, and I quote from their website, to provide diversified correctional and community reentry services, and I quote, with evidence-based rehabilitation programs. According to their outdated website, they operate only 9 ICE centers in the U.S. among a myriad of correctional facilities internationally and domestically, including those in Plainfield and Newcastle, Indiana. Roz Baraka, in his stance against this empire and in support of everyone living in his community, proclaimed, "All of us here, every last one of us, I don't care what background you come from, what nationality, what language you speak, at some point, we have to stop these people from causing division between us." Friends, these are kingdom words. words of togetherness, presence, dwelling, love, and fleshed. So this week I got to thinking about what co-creation looks like here, in this context, as God is making all things new. I wonder what tears God is touching today. In each of us individually and as a collected whole, as we navigate the empire that exists in opposition to the kingdom today. I wonder what the Spirit is sparking in us to commit to what's already in front of us and start dreaming. That we might enflesh the words, look, the tent of God is among human beings, indeed dwelling with us, existing as kin in God's presence. An invitation from our friends at Enflesh spoke to me and sums things up well, so I am going to actually just read it to you as a way to stir our imaginations. In closing, hear these words. John invites us to start talking about what could happen if we neither passively waited for change to one day come or practice gradualism and settle for small tweaks of destructive systems as our long-term goal. What could our community look like if it were made entirely new? What would we desire to change, and what would we replace those parts with? What could our churches look like if we let go of them enough for them to change so drastically that they are best described with the language of a whole new earth? What if we looked at a system like the criminal legal system or the education system or the healthcare system and imagined what God might do with them if we were open to them being made entirely new? If young, radical, black, queer activists imagined up a healthcare system, how different would it be? If seniors who immigrated to the U.S. with families got to dream about how public schools look in their community, how different would they be? If trans women and single mothers and rural women who farm and young non-binary people were painting their ideal picture of a criminal legal system, how different would it be from what we have today? It's unlikely that these dreams would manifest in small tweaks of what we have. They would more likely take shape with different relational practices, different values, different priorities that heal so many of the wounds caused by the built-in injustices of our current systems. This radical reimagining of what could be, knowing that our dreams set the course for our lives and how we live them, is inherent to the work of faith. This is spiritual work. This is love work. This is liberative work. As Christians, if we are not dreaming beyond what seems and feels possible today, what is the point of our faith? If we are not working towards something totally different, free of evil and oppression here among us, do we really believe God makes all? Trinity family, may our dreams and imagination be the way that we make oppression temporary today as we join God in co-creation of the kingdom here and now. May it be so. Amen. I want to invite you to turn to the Lord's Table liturgy. Y'all, I had way too much coffee this morning. My mouth is not working. As a reminder, our elements are gluten-free, not allergen-free, and it is open for anyone who would like to participate this morning. And that is juice, not wine, if you were wondering. That'd be my spouse. Alrighty, you can join in the bolded parts. Here at the table, we come before you, Lord God, and we remember Jesus' work and words so we might live according to his ways and proclaim the mystery revealed in faith. Living, Christ showed us how to live. Dying, Christ showed us how to trust. Raised, Christ revealed resurrection hope for all. Now and always, Christ is with us. The table of the Lord is open for all who seek the life with Christ.